11, Boomers, Sooners, and Oklahoma Territory. Chapter Preview, Terms, Dawes Severalty Act, Curtis Act, Boomer, Rider, Squatter, Sooner, Organic Act, Township, Normal School. People, Chito Harho, Elias C. Boudinot, David L. Payne, George W. Steele, Thompson B. Ferguson. Places, unassigned lands, Oklahoma City, Guthrie, Langston, Greer County, Cimarron Territory. As early as the 1860s, some people in the United States were looking towards the Indian Territory as one of the most desirable regions on the continent. A New York Times reporter wrote of the, quote, necessity of some arrangement being made advantageous to the Indians, as well as to the prospective white settlers in the splendid region designated the Indian Territory. The necessities of our Western growth demand the useful occupation of this region, and we believe it is possible to secure it. End quote. Section 1. Dissolving a Way of Life. As you read, look for the steps taken by the federal government to break up the Indian nations in the late 1800s, land allotments to the 5 civilized tribes, and vocabulary terms, Dawes Severalty Act, Curtis Act, Boomer, Rider, Squatter, and Sooner. In 1870, federal policy toward Native Americans began to change from removal, treaties, and reservations to breaking up the Indian nations. An 1870 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Cherokee tobacco case stated that federal laws took precedence over treaties. In 1871, Congress passed a law stating no new treaties would be made with Indian tribes, since they were no longer sovereign nations. Indians' rights were severely affected by the law, since negotiations were no longer needed for Congress to make changes in Native American matters. The Dawes Act. In the 1880s, several people with sincere intentions believed that it was in the best interest of the Native Americans to allot their tribal lands to individual tribal members. A reform group known as Friends of the Indians, led by Alice Fletcher of New York, worked with Massachusetts Senator Henry Dawes, chairman of the Congressional Indian Affairs Committee, to develop a plan to save the Indians by dividing their lands into homesteads. Fletcher and others felt that allotment would mainstream Indians into white society. In 1887, Congress passed the Dawes Severalty Act, authored by Senator Dawes. Until then, Indian lands were owned by the tribe as a whole rather than by individual members of the nation. The Dawes Act dissolved tribal ownership, primarily in western Oklahoma, and gave specific amounts of land to each individual Indian. It also extended the protection of U.S. laws over the Indians. Initially, the Act did not extend to lands occupied by the 5 tribes, the Osage, Miami, Peoria, and Sac and Fox lands in the Indian Territory, the Seneca Nation of New York, and land adjoining the Sioux Nation of Nebraska. An amendment in 1890 extended the Act to include the Sac and Fox, and in 1893, Congress extended the Act to the other tribes. Allotments and the 5 tribes. The Dawes Commission turned its attention to negotiating the exchange of tribal lands held in commonality by the 5 tribes for allotments in severalty, lands held by one individual. In 1895, Congress ordered a survey of Indian Territory. The Dawes Commission was also directed in 1895 to make a tribal roll and to begin making land assignments without tribal approval. All of the tribes protested allotment, but in 1897, the Choctaw and Chickasaw were the first to sign allotment agreements. In what is called the Atoka Agreement, Each member of the two tribes received about 320 acres of land, and each freedman received 40 acres. The Muscogee, Creek, and Seminole also signed agreements in 1897 in which each Creek member and freedman received about 160 acres, and each Seminole was allotted 120 acres. Intended to force allotment and compliance, the 1898 Curtis Act was a blow against tribal rights. According to the legislation, tribal lands could be divided and Indian governments could be abolished unless they agreed to land allotments. The act abolished tribal courts and made everyone in Indian Territory subject to federal law and the laws of Arkansas. The allotment agreements abolished all tribal governments by 1906. Congress continued taking away tribal rights with a 1901 act that authorized that tribal rolls be closed. The act also required presidential approval of any legislation passed by the Cherokee and Creek tribes. All Indians who had been allotted land were made citizens of the United States. However, the new citizens were a small minority in the lands they received, which were to remain in their possession forever as long as the grass grows. Although the Creek tribe had signed an allotment agreement, a group led by Chito Harjo, also known as Crazy Snake, resisted the action. In 1901, Harjo's group formed its own government and in some cases arrested and whipped Creek who accepted allotments. The Crazy Snake Rebellion ended when federal authorities arrested several members of the group. They finally accepted allotment rather than go to prison. By 1902, the Cherokee tribe had also agreed to allotment, but a secret society called the Kituwa refused to recognize the agreement. The Kituwa planned to continue to hold their lands in common. Under the threat of federal marshals, however, they consented to allotment. Each Cherokee and freedman was assigned about 110 acres. Boomers. Pressure had been mounting to open to white settlers a tract of land in the heart of Indian Territory called the unassigned lands. The 2 million acres had been taken for other Indian tribes from the Creek and the Seminole in the 1866 treaties, but no other tribes had been relocated there. The unassigned lands included most of present-day Payne, Logan, Kingfisher, Canadian, Oklahoma, and Cleveland counties. Mixed blood Elias C. Boudinot, son of the Cherokee leader of the same name, felt that progress and the Indians' economy would be best served by opening the unassigned lands. Boudinot openly promoted the unoccupied lands for settlement, and in 1879 he wrote an article for the Chicago Times which described the unassigned lands that he believed were in the public domain. The idea of white settlement in the Oklahoma lands was also promoted by Dr. Morrison Munford in the Kansas City Times. Munford was the first to use the term boomer to describe the settlement movement. Boomers were those who took part in the land booms of the late 1800s when western land was open to settlement. The settlement movement didn't need much encouragement. Two men, James Madison Bell, a Cherokee, and Captain Sears, made attempts in 1879 to settle in the area, but soldiers made them leave each time. Colonel Charles C. Carpenter, fresh off a similar settlement of non-public land in South Dakota, put together a group of homesteaders in Kansas in 1879. They hoped to establish a settlement on the North Canadian River in Indian Territory, but they were soon turned back by U.S. troops. The threat of arrest discouraged Carpenter from further settlement attempts. President Rutherford Hayes also warned settlers to stay out of Indian Territory, but that too had little effect. David L. Payne, a Kansas pioneer settler and politician, continued the wave of settlement attempts in the territory in 1880. Eluding patrolling soldiers, Payne led a group of 21 men across the border on a six-day ride to the bank of the North Canadian River in the unassigned lands at present-day Oklahoma City. Soon after arriving on May 2nd, Payne sent word to the Wichita newspapers that the settlers had been successful. The group built a stockade and marked off a capital city. Lieutenant George H. G. Gale and the 4th Cavalry from Fort Reno soon broke up the new settlement. Payne and the settlers were escorted back to Kansas. Not intimidated, Payne led an even larger group back to the same settlement site in July 1880. Troops soon arrested the invaders. Those who were first offenders were escorted back to Kansas, but Payne had to go before Judge Parker at the Fort Smith Federal Court. The court set Payne free. He gained even more publicity from the trial and received a hero's welcome in Kansas. He led several other groups of settlers into the unassigned lands and traveled to Washington, D.C. several times to lobby for opening the lands. Payne's final effort at settling the lands came in June 1884 at a tent settlement called Rock Falls in the Cherokee Outlet. He quickly set up a printing press and published the Oklahoma War Chief newspaper, which, of course, called for opening the lands. Soldiers arrived at the settlement and destroyed the printing press, but not before Payne had gained national attention. Payne died suddenly in November 1884 in Kansas. William L. Couch, a Payne supporter, immediately took up the cause. In December 1884, Couch led the 15th group of intruders of almost 400 men, women, and children to the site of present-day Stillwater, camping on Boomer Creek. Lieutenant M. H. Day and his Buffalo Soldier troops from Camp Russell arrived at the camp on December 24th. When the settlers refused to leave, Day ordered his troops to use their weapons on the group, but the soldiers refused. Day quickly realized gunfire wasn't the answer, and he withdrew and waited for reinforcements. Colonel Edward L. Hatch arrived on January 11th with 7 companies of the 9th Cavalry, 2 howitzers, and an infantry company. The troops surrounded the camp and cut off incoming supplies. The Boomers held out as long as they could without supplies, but they finally had to surrender and were peacefully escorted back to Kansas. Indian response. The Indians followed the Boomer movement with alarm. All non-Indians were forbidden from being in Indian territory by federal laws and treaties, but Boomers used brazen tactics to get around or overlook the law. Indians tried to battle the movement by sending delegates to Washington, D.C. to remind officials of their obligations to the Native Americans. Tribes near the unassigned lands helped agents watch for any illegal movement. Many tribes in the territory sent representatives to international councils, which stressed the need for unified action against the Boomer movement. Judge Parker invited council representatives to help prosecute Payne, and in so doing, they visited Boomer camps. The Indians found the settlers to be impoverished and ill-equipped, and this dampened somewhat the Native Americans' threats of armed resistance. Judge Parker ruled in 1881 that the tribes retained an interest in the unassigned lands, which strengthened the non-public status of the area. The small victory, though, didn't stop the movement of the homesteaders. The Springer Amendment. The legal wrangling over opening the unassigned lands continued in the nation's capital. Sensing the inevitable, Pleasant Porter of the Muscogee Creek tribe and others offered to give up all claims to the unassigned lands for almost $2.25 million. In spite of criticism from fellow tribal members, the agreement was finalized in the winter of 1889. An amendment written by Indiana Representative William Springer was rushed through Congress on March 2, 1889, to open the unassigned lands to settlement. The bill was attached as a rider, an addition, to the annual Indian Appropriation Act, which left President Grover Cleveland little choice but to sign it into law. In only his third week in office, President Benjamin Harrison issued a proclamation on March 3, 1889, for settling the unassigned lands. Anyone eligible under the Homestead Act would be allowed to enter the area at noon on April 22, 1889, and claim a homestead. Illegal squatters were to be escorted from the area. A squatter is one who settles on unoccupied land in order to gain title to it. Despite hundreds of patrolling troops, several Sooners did slip by and stake out choice claims. A Sooner was a person who crossed the starting line of a land run before the appointed time. The first land opening. President Harrison issues his proclamation opening up the coveted acres, was published in the Decatur Republican in Illinois. Hooray for Oklahoma, pioneers by thousands on the march, was published in the New York Times. We'll invade Oklahoma, cities of southwestern Kansas gone crazy over the boom, was published in the Chicago Daily Tribune. Word spread quickly throughout the country of the proposed land opening in the Indian Territory. The land opening offered hope for those seeking a new life and adventure for those who enjoyed a good thrill. The lure of free land brought young and old, poor and rich, men and women, white and black, to the promised land. People began arriving in Kansas, Texas, and Arkansas days ahead of time. Some came in colonies or with their families. Some came alone. They gathered on the south side of the lands at Purcell, on the north side in Kansas, and in the Cherokee Outlet, and on the west near Fort Reno and King Fisher Stage Station. King David Fisher's station site is within the city limits of present-day Kingfisher, first called Lisbon. A New York Times reporter on the Santa Fe train heading south out of Kansas observed, quote, "There was a steady movement all night, and then it happened that when the 10 o'clock train on the Santa Fe had crossed the Arkansas and mounted the divide, the passengers were treated to the sight of a seemingly endless procession of white-capped wagons moving rapidly along the trail which parallels the railroad to Guthrie and beyond. As far as the eye could reach, looking north and south, the level green plain was dotted with wagons, horses, and men. There were a dozen Oto Indians on the train en route to their reservation, and they looked with anything but kindly eyes on the panorama." The train, which took its leisurely flight southward through the Indian Territory, today was composed of 5 coaches, each comfortably filled with boomers who had apparently reached the conclusion that their chances of securing quarter sections in the promised land would be greatly improved if they went to Purcell and entered the army of Texans now camped there on the banks of the Canadian. End quote. The run for the unassigned lands. People who had been able to sleep the night before were up early on April 22nd. The ghostly forms of prairie schooners could be seen moving toward the ford on the river. When the ford became jammed with wagons, some began trying to cross the river at any point, although quicksand hampered that effort. Horses were saddled and bridled. Bit and girth were checked again and again. No cavalryman going on inspection ever paid such minute attention to details as did these homeseekers. Trains packed with people rolled across the prairie. Wagons and horses were joined by buggies, surreys, bicycles, mules, and even people on foot. Time inched forward slowly. The reporter on the train continued, quote, "At 11:40 o'clock, the conductor of the long special train on the siding gave the signal. The engines whistled shrilly, and the special began its trip Oklahomaward. It seemed as if every man on the train shouted when the train moved, and a moment later the sound of pistol shots told that the Texans were firing their salute. The succeeding 20 minutes were the longest of the day to those on the banks of the river. Suddenly, Lieutenant Adair is seen to motion to the soldier near him, and the next moment the cheerful strains of the recall are sounded. In an instant, the scene changes. There is a mighty shout, and the advance guard of the invading army is racing like mad across the sands toward the narrow expanse of water. The north and south wings seem to strike the water together. In they go, helter-skelter, every rider intent on reaching the bank first. There goes a horse into a deep hole, and his rider falls headlong out of the saddle. The racers take different directions. The spyglass detects dozens of men miles beyond the river. These are boomers who have been hiding. End quote. Within a few hours, all of the 2 million acres of the unassigned lands were claimed. Estimates of the number of people who made the run varied from 50,000 to 100,000. Claiming land. Surveyors had previously left an inscribed cornerstone on each quarter section of land. People claiming land had to first find the stone to get the land description, which then had to be filed at a federal land office at Guthrie or Kingfisher Station. Homesteaders had to pay a small filing fee and live on the land 5 years before they could obtain actual title to the property. There were often disputes over who filed first for a particular section of land. Some cases were settled in court, while others were settled with fists or guns. Although many people won their race for land, there was also a large number who did not. Some who weren't successful in the land run left disappointed, but others simply turned their focus to helping settle one of several new towns that instantly sprang up. New towns. The Seminole Town Site and Improvement Company was allowed to enter the territory early to survey town sites at several stations. Other companies also surveyed town sites. At times the surveys overlapped, causing confusion. The mass of people caused towns of tents to instantly be established at Guthrie, Edmond, Oklahoma Station, Verbeck, Moore, Norman, Stillwater, and Lisbon, Kingfisher. Oklahoma City was estimated to have a population of 12,000 on its first day of existence. By April 23rd, Guthrie was a city of 10,000 people, and it had 15,000 people 3 months later. Even though the town's beginnings were chaotic, most quickly began to organize local governments. Guthrie's election of a mayor was held on April 23rd. With no time to print ballots, voters lined up and each man's vote was tallied. The system was sometimes compromised when, after voting, a few people ran to the back of the line and voted again. A tent and a shingle, sign, were all that was needed to set up shop in the new towns. Lawyers filed claims for clients. Three men with only a few pennies to their name opened the Bank of Guthrie with a pot-bellied stove for a vault. Frank Greer arrived in Guthrie with a printing press and immediately began setting type for the first edition of the town's first newspaper. Blacksmiths and barbers also served as dentists. The overwhelming number of people soon caused a shortage of food and water in Guthrie. A Harper's Weekly reporter wrote, quote, "Dusty ham sandwiches sold as high as 25 cents each, while in the restaurants a plate of pork and beans was valued at 75 cents. End quote. Dust and heat intensified the burning thirst. Until water wells could be drilled, the only sources of water for the Guthrie area were the Cimarron River and Cottonwood Creek. At the Oklahoma City station, as in Guthrie, many of the best town lots were illegally claimed ahead of time by deputy marshals and railroad officials. The Reverend James Murray and a Mr. Kincaid of the Oklahoma colony of boomers from Kansas may have been the first legal claimants. nearly 1,000 blacks made the 1888 land run, and many others came to the territory later. Edward McCabe, an African-American who had served as state auditor in Kansas, purchased 160 acres about 11 miles east of Guthrie. McCabe established the town of Langston at the site in 1890. He soon published a newspaper, the Langston Herald, to promote the town to black settlers. McCabe's plan for an all-black state didn't materialize, but his publicity caught the attention of many. A large number of African Americans soon moved to the territory. Eventually, some 50 black communities were established in Oklahoma, more than in any other state. Homesteading. Homesteading acclaim meant much more than building a shelter, although that was an important step. The geography of the area determined in large part the type of shelter a family built and the type of crops they grew. West of the Cross Timbers area, trees grew primarily along rivers and creeks. Shipping in lumber was far too costly, so early settlers used their wagons or a tent until they could build a dugout or soddy. Depending on when their claim was settled, a family's house had to wait until the land could be broken up for plowing and a crop planted. Often a barn was built before the house. Settlers built dugouts into the sides of hills or ravine banks and covered them with cottonwood poles or straw or whatever materials they could find for a roof. Often they left a small opening beside the door for a window. Sometimes a house was built from the soil, which contained the densely packed roots of the prairie grass. These sod houses were made from sod bricks that were either dug with a spade or with a special plow that cut a strip 12 inches wide by 4 inches thick. The sod slabs were then stacked on top of each other to make a one-room house. Hanging blankets divided the room if needed, and windows could be added. Floors were usually dirt. Roofs were made of cedar, cottonwood, willow, or brush, topped with more prairie grass and sod. If clay was available, it was used to chink any cracks. Sod houses were naturally insulated and provided a safe haven from prairie wildfires. Heavy rains, however, caused mud and water to leak into the house. Snakes, spiders, insects, and mice were part of daily life in a soddy. A canopy was often placed over the cook stove to prevent things from falling into the food. If the family's farm was successful, in a few years they built a wood frame house with wood floors. Usually the houses were small to begin with, but additions were made when the family had the means to do so. Cellars, or frady holes, provided protection from severe storms and tornadoes, as well as cool places to store canned fruits and vegetables. Windmills pumped water from the ground for the family and the livestock. A cistern held rainwater when underground water couldn't be found. A vegetable garden helped feed the family. Bread was often made from a sourdough starter, which took the place of dry yeast, and most settlers carefully brought their starter with them. Many settlers also brought along a favorite rose or other hardy plant. It's your turn. Number 1. What was the purpose of the Dawes Severalty Act? Number 2. Where were the unassigned lands? Number 3. Who were the Sooners? Number 4. How did people acquire land in the land run for the unassigned lands?